So the other day I got an email from the White House about health reform, and I thought, this means that there's a list of all the people's email addresses stored on a government computer, and what if someone filed a Freedom of Information Act request and was able to get that list? Would they get my email? I'm Andrew Pratt, Managing Editor of Science Progress, and for this latest edition of our Wonk Lab podcast series, I'm turning to one of my Center for American Progress colleagues, Senior Fellow Peter Swire, so that we can talk about the email, the tweets, the YouTube videos, the blog posts all coming out of the White House, and why they're different from the ones that came out of BarackObama.com. Peter was a lawyer for Change.gov during the transition, and he's written a set of reports coming out today based on his observations as a private citizen about the key issues in new media, Web 2.0 tools, and federal policy. Peter, thank you for joining us on the Science Progress podcast.
Great to be here, Andrew.
We're going to talk about Web 2.0 and federal policy, and I just want to start off by asking the question, why isn't the White House up to the same speed as BarackObama.com was during the campaign? There's a lot of tools that people got used to seeing on the campaign that you don't see on WhiteHouse.gov. Why is that?
Well, it's not the campaign anymore, right? That's the basic point. One part is really simple. They had 170 people in new media the day the campaign ended. They have about 10 in the White House today to do more or less the same new media jobs. It's just, and 10 means they got 10 jobs inside the White House complex that they took away from other functions, from health care or from everything else it takes to run the White House, solving the economic crisis. So getting 10 jobs is an unbelievable victory on one level. But if you were running that 170-person team, you're going, wow, man, this is a lot harder than it was.
What does the new media team look like within the White House? Is this embedded within the communication shop? It probably looks a whole lot different if you've scaled down by a factor of 17. What does this job look like?
New media is really tied into to communications. But it also has to have a technological home. They have to be able to do the cool things they're going to do. And so it's really where technology and communications comes together. And the 2.0 part, the new media part, tends to be video, and it tends to be user-generated content. Those are the things that really mark Web 2.0.
So we were talking about the tools that people had during the campaign versus the tools that were available in the White House. A lot of those campaigners were using Facebook, were using Instant Messenger, were using their Gmail accounts, were using all these Web 2.0 technologies to get information flowing during the campaign. They came into a White House where the technology was not up to speed. How do you adapt? What's the difference between those two?
Well, on day one, it was really hard. You know, there were desks where there was no desktop that worked. There was no software that worked, et cetera. I think for the people who were on the campaign, they were used to immersion in social networking. And some of that changes when you go into government because you have to be formal and you can't help your buddies and not help other people. But for all the outreach people, for all the communications people, for all the people mobilizing on health care or 100 different issues, you still have to reach out. And a lot of these tools have been prohibited by federal employees, but they're the best tools for getting the president's message out and for getting the president's work done. And so there's this real generational shift, and there's a real, boy, we have to change these rules here. On the other hand, the security folks in the White House, look, security when you're in the White House is a lot different, right? Bad guys hack you. Bad guys try to find back doors. If there's a sloppy person using, you know, whatever, BlackBerry, whatever it is, and they're letting in hackers into the White House, that's a major deal. So there's a reality that you have to be more careful, but there's a reality that you have to make sure the technology gets updated. They've started to do that. They've made some progress, but it's really going to take some thinking about which apps, which things they can do so that the communications can go forward effectively.
Can these tools also help people do work better internally? Using social networks to communicate with other people within government? Is it all about outward facing and protecting people's privacy and accessibility when you're talking to the public? Or are these things these tools can do internally to make government run better?
Look, government people in government are people too. You know, if there's collaboration tools that work on the outside, there's collaboration tools that can work on the inside. And the Department of Homeland Security is doing social networking conference at the end of June that I'm participating in. You know, they don't seem like the most touchy-feely folks, but they're realizing 200,000 employees, we ought to find some way to talk with each other. How do we do it?
Are things getting better from the people that you've talked with who may be working in the White House or federal agencies about getting these tools?
Sure. The tools, right. There's just an entirely different view from this. It's not just a generation. It's a campaign that believes that technology should go forward on the IT front. You know, the oil folks in the last round, they just weren't really pushing IT. They just weren't. And now they do believe in it. The president wants to have BlackBerries and other devices. So we're seeing changes. What we've written about in these papers is what are the policies that need to change so that we get the right things going forward for the people who work in the government, for the people on the outside who want to participate. We learn what the real constraints are, and then we learn how to approach those.
Sounds fantastic.
Let me tell you a little bit more about what's different in the White House, because that's one of the papers that we have here. There's three big differences from just running a normal thing. One is scale. How many people comment to the White House? A whole lot. How many interns do you have to answer? Not that many. A second big issue that's really, really hard is what they call clearance in the White House. I worked in the White House under President Clinton, and I learned that before you say something, the different agencies have to weigh in. The different experts have to weigh in. Before you say a sentence, you have to make sure you're saying it right. And you know, here's a story that I can tell about that. Imagine if you get a question about what we should do about North Korea. Maybe there was a flap about North Korea last week or yesterday or suddenly 10 minutes ago. And during the campaign, you call up your North Korea expert, and he or she is so happy to answer your call because they want to help the campaign win. During the governance, they might be over in the State Department dealing with the mess. Right? You call them, they're a little busy. They're talking to the North Korean ambassador or something. Who knows what they're doing, but they're busy. So let's say you go out with your best guess. You put up on the White House website, here's what we think should happen next. Turns out that was last week's talking point. A lot has happened since then. North Koreans get upset. They launch a missile. That would ruin your whole day. You're the new media guy, and it's like, oh, man, I thought, you know, but suddenly your new media quick interaction, doing your best guess of what works, doing a quick and dirty Web 2.0, that doesn't cut it in the White House.
So is that one of the reasons why we actually don't see comments on the OMB or the White House blogs?
It's a reason why the tools they use are tools that mean you as the individual citizen get to vote, you as the individual citizen get to do a comment, but you get a lot fewer answers back. Because those answers can't be casual anymore. They have to be cleared answers that are just right. And it's too risky to have somebody saying, on behalf of the White House, here's my North Korea thing. That's just a problem.
Cleared answers, not casual answers. No, that sounds dead on. So what's harder when you are running the government than while you're on the campaign trail with regard to using these tools?
Here's one thing that's harder. During the campaign, if five teenagers get in an old minibus and start campaigning in some weird neighborhood that they've never been visiting before, they can campaign for the Obama campaign, and that's okay. It's good stuff that's never happened before. If those five teenagers are representing the White House, uh-oh, that's like, who knows what they're doing? Who knows what they look like or what they've been smoking? So you just got to be really aware that you can't just empower people to say, hey, now we're the White House, because all sorts of crazy things can happen.
It's that same sort of clearance issue you were talking about with North Korea. It's
clearance is what we say for the campaign, and endorsement is you only get to speak for us if you're really speaking for us. We're not just going to let the five crazy teenagers do it.
One of the issues that you address here has to do with privacy, which is multifaceted. There's a lot to it. Some of it's complex. Some of it's very accessible. One of the problems with privacy on these websites has to do with cookies. What is a cookie on a website? Can you tell us what that is and why we should care about it?
Yeah, and my new media friends got mad at me because I worked on privacy in the Clinton administration and was there when we put this no cookies policy up on websites. Because back in 2000, when I was working on it, this was like the scary way people could get tracked when they came to government websites. And people were all freaked out, and understandably, hey, I'm just surfing at the website, and now they know everywhere I've gone. So cookie is the software technique where a website can figure out it's your computer coming back that was here last week, that was here last month. It can track the device and say it's the same device that's coming back. So if for instance, they saw an advertisement the first time, the cookie shows you've already seen that ad. Now we're going to show advertisement number two, advertisement number three. That's why it happens on the web, among other things. When the government's doing it, the rules are stricter. They're not supposed to be casually surveilling the citizens. So now we've got this cookie policy from 2000. Lots happened. It's 2009. A lot of web cool things happened that weren't even dreamed of back then. And so one of the challenges for the administration is, okay, how do we take the don't invade your privacy instinct and take the let's be cool with 2.0 instinct and work on both of those? How do we do the chocolate and peanut butter together? And that's the question. The answer is still in development. And, you know, I have some ideas on that. The papers talk about some ways. Basically, you have to basically get the tech people, the 2.0 people, the privacy people, have them work together to figure out what the next generation techniques are so that you get good service from the websites, from the government, but you're not tracking people when you shouldn't be.
So what is peanut butter and chocolate lettuce do? What kind of service could you better provide if you had a sensible cookie policy?
So one thing cookies can do is what are called web analytics. We can find out there's different users. You know, I've talked to people who work on the NIH site, National Institutes of Health site. Some people go in are researchers who are there all the time trying to figure out how to get their grants or how to post new research. Some people is somebody who think they might have cancer and want to get good research. Those are really different users. And if we use cookies, we might be able to move them towards the side of the site that seems to fit that kind of user. It's personalization. It's giving them what they want. It's not asking inappropriate survey questions. It's giving better customer service.
No, that makes sense. So I got an email the other day from from the White House. Thank you. I felt very privileged about healthcare reform. And I presume other people got this as well. So
yes.
there's a list, there's a database of email addresses. What would happen if someone filed a Freedom of Information request and said, I want that entire list. I want to see everyone's email.
Okay, so great. So two things. One is that there's a sign up. You can sign up for a White House account just like you sign up for a Yahoo account or something. And then when you sign up, you are agreeing, hey, I want to get communicated with. I can receive emails. They don't just randomly send it out. And there's no mixing of the lists from the campaign with the lists of White House users. That's worth knowing. Now, the next question you asked is, hey, so now we've got 1 million people signed up. And we'd like to raise money from them or send them hate mail if we're Republicans. We don't like these people who signed up for the Democrats. So they do a Freedom of Information Act request. And they say this is a government file. We ought to be able to see who's using the White House. We might be social science researchers trying to find out truth and what's – okay. Under FOIA, under the Freedom of Information Act, there's something called an exception for privacy. The people agreed that they were going to be part they wanted to receive White House communications. They didn't agree that they wanted their name sent out to anybody who wanted to. This is something that we don't have clear guidance on yet. I think it's worth saying that just saying you want to receive email shouldn't mean that your name has to be exposed. That's not what happens in the private sector. People will be surprised if it happens. If you start to do more substantial things, you comment publicly with your name on it, then your name's out there in public. But just saying you want to receive communications, I don't see why that should be sent out to everybody.
So I'm safe if I'm signing up right now. No one can.
Well, today we don't have guidance on FOIA. That's part of what we did in these papers is identify some of the tricky issues that have to be addressed. The administration's been a little busy the first few months. They've answered a bunch of questions, tried to solve the financial crisis, you know, changed Iraq and Afghanistan, but they haven't fixed every single Web 2.0 issue in the first 4 months.
Email isn't necessarily a Web 2.0 issue. That, you know, we had that back in the 90s. There's some much more contemporary tools that we're talking about here that you want to be able to use on these websites. And one of the issues, in addition to privacy that you write about, is the accessibility issue of some of these tools. Not everyone can see web pages. Not everyone can hear the multimedia that's on them. What's important to understand about accessibility when we're talking about new Web 2.0 tools?
Well, for one thing, it's the law. So the federal government, when it does computers, is supposed to follow Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act, which is a long way of saying it's supposed to be accessible to different sorts of people. Some people are colorblind. You shouldn't put red and green next to each other. And I learned a lot about this when I was working as a lawyer with Change.gov. There's just a lot of different accessibility. Closed captioning is required for federal videos because people ought to be able to people who can't hear well. Not just people who are deaf, older people, lots of people can't hear well, don't have good connections. They ought to be able to know what the words say. That's a financial burden. It's something we didn't see in the campaign. It's something that YouTube and lots of commercial sites don't do. But part of being in the federal government is that you're there for all the people in America, and you have to be accessible to all the people in America. And that's forcing some of the 2.0 tools up to new levels of performance that haven't happened in the private sector.
Does the federal government have the power to make these companies that build these tools think about these issues?
Well, they're certainly thinking about them because their products can't be on federal websites unless they're accessible. And then the next stage is if you link to something off the federal website, you have some cool service off-site in the private sector, the federal government's saying, look, you know, we're the federal government. If we're going to play with you, we have to make it so it's accessible to all the people of America. And that's putting pressure. Facebook's upgraded some of it for people who are visually impaired recently. And I think it's very constructive because, you know, when you're doing your beta test for your cool new app, you do it for the biggest part of the audience. You do it for whatever a quick hit is. But these things are becoming more mainstream. And to say to people, you can't play, you can't read, you can't hear, that's becoming really not an option. So the government's going to try to push people to better practices here.
Well, that sounds it sounds like they do have some of that power. And if not, then they're not going to play with those tools.
Well, if you don't have closed captioning, it's not going to be on federal websites. If you're a video site, you better be thinking about that.
One of the other things that you talk about is the difference between large federal agencies using these tools and the small local office in Boise, Idaho using these tools.
Yeah, some people in Boise – I had a complaint from somebody in Idaho when I was working on a draft in this. But here's my point on this. If you're the WhiteHouse.gov and you want to cut a deal with a Facebook, with YouTube, whoever, they'll meet with you. If you're the National Forest Service webmaster just trying to get people hiking in the National Forest, you know, they'll say, that's really nice, but we just don't have time to meet with you and come up with all these weird federal rules. And so it means that the government-wide people in the General Services Administration and the White House people, they're going to be the change agents. They're going to be the ones who can get changes in the rules for accessibility, for privacy, for other things that then can spread government-wide. But here's the other thing. The other thing is you want experimentation. You don't want to wait till the White House agrees to something. You don't want to wait till it works for every agency in the government. Trying out some stuff first, that's a good idea too. And so part of what happens here is we should move forward for the big heavy hitters, the government-wide or the WhiteHouse.gov, to make big changes. And we should also have room for experimentation, trying out things, seeing what works before we try to go government-wide. That's the trick, is coming up a policy that will let the experimental people out in the field and the people at the center both be moving forward with these good technologies.
For the startup companies that may be coming up with the next hip tool that we're using next year or the year after, is it worth it to incorporate these privacy and accessibility components into their tools? Are they going to care if it's a badge of honor that the EPA is using their tool?
I think a lot of the Web 2.0 developers would like it if they're part of the federal government national scene. That's a lot of viewers. If they get on WhiteHouse.gov, they can like tell their wives or husbands how cool they are. So cool is good, and being on the WhiteHouse.gov is good. And also, I think as we have these discussions, developers start to say, oh, you know, I never really paid attention to accessibility. I sort of didn't want to because it's like extra homework assignment I don't feel like doing. But really, I should make it so the colorblind people and visually impaired people and auditorily impaired people and folks like that have a chance to play here. And we're not going to go forward and become the cool thing that's used by everybody if we're cutting out millions and millions of people. And so the government here plays an educational function to try to show what's possible and what's the right thing to do.
Now, one of the other things that the Obama administration said they were going to do was open up government and be more transparent. Do these rules for Web 2.0 tools, are they going to help make government more transparent? What's the connection there?
Well, transparent and open, part of it is do you just put the information out there or do you say everything's a secret? And there's lots of things that were considered secrets in the Bush administration that are already being open here. One of the first things the new Attorney General, Eric Holder, did is say a presumption under Freedom of Information Act is we're going to be open. And the rules under Bush-Cheney had been, you know, look for reasons to be secret. You were worried about security all the time. So we've seen a lot of openness. But in terms of these tools, part of what we write about in these papers is ways that citizens can feel like they're participating and can actually participate. We try to see what the real obstacles are to that, like it has to be cleared before you can go out and say things or some other obstacles. And then we try to figure out what are the best ways to fix those. That's what some of what these papers are about.
What else should we cover that people really need to understand is important that we haven't been talking about here?
There's some obstacles to using Web 2.0 that only a nerd or a lawyer would care about, but they're pretty important. Here's one of them. The terms of use you sign up for when you're in Web 2.0. The terms of use say that state law will govern. Well, the problem is that's unconstitutional when it applies to the federal government. McCulloch versus Maryland, you know, the federal government supreme, and the state law in Idaho, California, someone else can't control. So you got to fix that. A lot of the terms of use say that you have to indemnify, pay back the software service for any problems. That's also illegal. There's a statute called the Anti-Deficiency Act. It's illegal for that federal employee to bind the government through those terms of use. So you really don't like your federal employees breaking the law and doing unconstitutional things. It's just not a good way to go. So part of what has to happen is change the terms of use. And that's a little obscure. And the companies have to understand this isn't an option. It's the Constitution. It's the laws of the United States.
And this is one of the examples where this has to happen at the federal level. Again, small offices aren't going to have the kind of leverage to say you have to change your entire legal terms.
That's right. This isn't going to be something a small office can happen. It's going to take the weight of the federal government. So another issue is a lot of federal agencies have closed down Facebook, MySpace, and a lot of these devices, won't let their employees use it. Well, there's some reasons for that are understandable. One of them is security. Some of these services or some of the apps that plug into the services are not secure, and that is a concern. But let's imagine you're the communications office for that agency, and you're told you can't use social media. It just really cuts down on your day if you can't use Twitter or Facebook or MySpace or all the other tools that people are using. So there needs to be some recognition from inside the agencies that these are tools of business for the federal government. These aren't sort of weird things that like leftover teenagers are using. And so there's partly a generational thing or partly a security doesn't always win thing, that there's very valuable tools for communicating and participating, and you have to have ways to use those tools and not just to shut them down.
And besides, President Obama said that he wants to make government service cool. So these tools are a part of that.
They are part of it. The weekly radio addresses from previous presidents turn into the weekly video address. There's been lots of downloads. People feel connected to video. 10 years ago, video on the internet barely existed. The download speeds didn't work in dial-up. Today, video is huge, and government's got to learn to do that. Government's got to learn to do a lot of the interactive things. And people in government who are going to be communicating with their communities for work reasons have to find ways to be able to use these tools.
So what I like about these papers is you're really talking about issues that aren't just for people who are building federal websites. They're not just for people who are building new tools in Silicon Valley, and they're not just for people who want to know that their information is secure. It's really all these communities need to come together to figure out what's going to work on federal websites.
It's grand synthesis time, right? This is, you know, you got your lawyers, your techies, your policy geeks, your theorists of participation in a new era of American government. And you put all those people into the mix, and part of what we're trying to do with these papers is to get to a better mix, to find out what are the real obstacles, how do you fix them, what are the real ways to make a difference here.
Is it going to work?
Sure it's going to work. It's worked already, right? The weekly video addresses are up. The Facebook pages and MySpace pages are up. Lots is happening, but there's still less happening than there will be once we figure out how to solve some of these problems.
Well, it sounds like the way to go.
Hope so.
Peter Swire, thank you very much.
Glad to be here.